Parshas Vayera. What do we talk about Parshas Vayera? That's a very, very good question. We open up the Parsha and we have the story of Avraham Avinu brings in the three malachim. And there the Torah says, Vayikach chema v'chalav u'ben abakar asher asah. Avraham Avinu makes a very elaborate meal for all of them and he serves them. And they seem to go along with the program. So this is a very interesting story on a number of levels. Number one, I just read in the Sefer this week, it's an obvious point, but it's something to think about as you read the Parsha. It's very interesting. We're told that Avraham Avinu makes them wipe their feet. He makes them wash their feet before they come in. Why? Rashi tells us because he believed that they were Ovdei Avodah Zarah. Nu, so why do you invite them into your house? If you know that they're Ovdei Avodah Zarah, keep them out. The answer is, you're invited to my house on my terms. I have the ability to be nice to everyone on my own terms. So you want to come to my house, these are the rules. We have to set up boundaries. You got to leave your Avodah Zarah outside. You have to wash your feet. You have to get rid of everything. Then you come inside and you can join me. But what you learn from Avraham Avinu is that chesed is not something that is only supposed to be limited to the people who we feel closest with, who we identify with most. Chesed is something that sometimes goes way beyond our own small circle of influence, the small circle of people who we identify with. Sometimes it expands way beyond that. Now, do we want those influences in our house? Well, it has to be with guidelines and it has to be set up properly. But Avraham Avinu did just that. But then Rashi tells us something very, very fascinating, quoting in Gemara in Maseches Bava Metzia, it's also a Medrash, where the Gemara says, hey, take a step back and ask yourself, why did Avraham Avinu prepare this whole meal? Because he had guests. But they were malachim. So why did they eat? Malachim don't eat. The Gemara tells us that Malachi Hashareis don't eat, they don't drink, there's no kina, they don't do any bodily functions that we as human beings do. So what do? They came into the house and they ate. What was that about? They've never eaten in their experience as Malachim. Why did they change it now? Says Rashi, Malamed, we learn from here, She'al Yishana Adam Mimina Gamakum, that a person should not veer away from what the accepted norm is in that place. You have to follow the minhag. That's what Rashi learns, putting in Gemara. And the Malachim knew that conventional norm is when a guest comes to your house, they eat together with everybody else. So they decided to go along with the program and to eat as well. So I thought this was an appropriate time for us to have a little bit of a discussion about the importance of Minhagim. Al Yishana Anam Minhag HaMakom doesn't just mean that if everyone around you is eating, you should eat as well. Al Yishana Anam Minhag HaMakom means if you have a Minhag in your community, you should do your best to make sure that you follow that Minhag and that you adhere to it, even though sometimes it's inconvenient, and even though sometimes it doesn't make sense to you, and even though sometimes you would prefer not to, that's okay, but it's still a minhag. So by way of introduction to that very important discussion, I just want to digress for a few minutes to discuss the underpinnings of why it is that we're bound by a minhag in the first place. You could ask yourself a very obvious question. Why would a minhag bind me? I didn't take the minhag upon myself. So what is it? My great-great-great-grandparents somewhere along the way took something upon themselves and that becomes binding on me? How does that happen? What is the understanding of how exactly that works? So to understand that, we're going to go a few parashios ahead in Parshas Beshalach. And there we're told, as Klal Yisrael, as the Jewish people are about to leave the land of Mitzrayim and start on their journey, Vayigach Moshe es atzmos Yosef imo. We're told Moshe Rabbeinu takes the body of Yosef to travel together with the Jewish people. What was that all about? The Medrash tells us that the Jewish people are all running around taking the biza. They're all taking the spoils from the Mitzrayim. They're emptying out their homes. Moshe Rabbeinu is busy with the bones of Yosef. Why is he busy with that? So the Torah says, Ki hashbeya hishbiyas b'nei Yisrael emor. Because Yosef made the Jewish people take a swear, take a promise. Hakod yifkod Elokim eschem. HaKadosh Baruch Hu at some stage and later in history is going to take you out from Mitzrayim. And don't forget when that happens, says Yosef, Halisem es atzmosayim yizeh etchem. Don't forget that you're going to make sure to take me out of Mitzrayim also. When you leave Mitzrayim, don't allow yourselves to leave alone. Make sure that you take me along with you. I don't want to be left in Mitzrayim alone. That's what Moshe Rabbeinu says. Now Rashi there on Chumash asks, what does it mean, Hashbeya Hishbiya es b'nei Yisrael lemar? That he, if you want to look up the Pasuk later, it's Perek Yud Gimel, Pasuk Yud Tes, in Sefer Shemos, Parshas Beshalach. So Hashbeya Hishbiya, Rashi asks, what do you mean? He made them take a double Shvua? What does a double Shvua mean? If I don't trust somebody, if I'm not sure whether they're going to do something, I say, okay, swear to me. Promise me you're going to do this. Person promises. Say, no, promise again. Swear again. What is a double swear? If you don't trust them once, you don't trust them a second time either. And if you trusted them the first time, that was good enough. So what's hashbeya hishbiya? What's the double shvua about? Rashi explains, no, of course it doesn't mean he made his brothers take a double shvua to him. What's a double shvua? Double shvua means nothing. Hashbeya hishbiya means you take a shvua that you're going to make sure that all your children take a shvua as well. It's not only bonding on you, it's bonding on your children and on your grandchildren and on your great-grandchildren until we get out of Mitzrayim, whoever is going to be alive at that time. Even though they're not here today looking at me in the face, Yosef, and making the shvua to me, you take a shvua that you're going to make sure that they take a shvua. So that's the hashbeya hishbiya. This was something that went way beyond just that generation. It's something that lingered on a lot longer. So my father often quotes from the Rugged Shavar Gaon. The Rugged Shavar Gaon was one of the great Gaonim before the Holocaust. And he has a Tshuva Sefer called the Tshuvas Tefnas Paneach. So somebody once sent him the following Shaila. The Gemara says in Maseches Tshuvas that Klal Yisrael took Shalosh Shavuos. Anyone ever heard of the Shalosh Shavuos? So Shalosh Shavuos became very famous from the Satmar Rebbe. The Satmar Rebbe took the Gemara very literally, not only in an agadic sense, it's an agadic Gemara, where the Gemara says, based on a pasuk in Shir HaShirim, it says, Hishbati Eschem Benos Yerushalayim, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, I made you promise, Benos Yerushalayim means the Jewish people, B'tzivaos Oba Ailos HaSadayim Ta'iru V'im Ta'oru HaSa'ava HaChatechba. So, it's not clear exactly what the Shavua is, but it seems to be that there's some kind of Shavua that we took, we gave our word to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. What did we give our word about? Not clear. So the Gemara Maseches Ketubos in the end of the Masechta says, Shalosh Shavuos Hishviu HaKadosh Baruch Hu LeBnei Yisrael. There are three oaths, three promises that the Jewish people took upon themselves, and that's what it means over here. Hishbati Eschem Benos Yerushalayim. So the Satmar Rebbe made this very famous. It's an Agada to Gemara, but the Satmar Rebbe took it in a literal sense beyond the Agada, and he said one of the Shavuos is Shalosh Yalu B'Choma, that we're not going to go back to Eretz Yisrael until HaKadosh Baruch Hu clearly tells us that Mashiach has arrived and it's time to come back. And therefore he said that based on the Shavua we made to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we don't have a right to go back to Eretz Yisrael until HaKadosh Baruch Hu clearly says that it's time. And right now, 1948, HaKadosh Baruch Hu didn't say that it's time. Now others will interpret it to say, what do you mean? Is there a greater sign from HaKadosh Baruch Hu that it's time than the fact that we have Eretz Yisrael? Okay, you can debate it back and forth. But that's really where the whole Hashkafa stems from. And it's very well developed. I'm not saying positive or negative. It's a fascinating discussion. But that's really where the whole thing comes from, is from that Shavua that the Gemara learns from the Pasuk in Sefer Shir HaShir. So somebody sent the Shaila to the Rugged Shavar, and he says, let's say we take the Gemara literally. Let's say we say the Gemara is not just an Agadata. Usually an Agadata Gemara, I guess literally is not the right word. All Gemara should be taken literally. But when you have an Agadata Gemara, you have to understand what is the real meaning of the Gemara. What does the Gemara mean to teach us by telling the story? It's something usually behind the message. It's not just the simple words. So somebody said, let's say we take the Gemara at face value. And the Gemara means to teach us, until HaKadosh Baruch Hu allows us to go to Eretz Yisrael, we don't have a right to go on our own volition. It has to be something that the Ribbono Shel Olam initiates, that the Ribbono Shel Olam allows. Without that, we don't have a right. Let's say we take that Gemara in a literal sense. If that's the case, he says, Hishbati Eschem. How many years ago was Sefer Shir HaShirim written? A couple of thousand years ago. I wasn't there. I didn't take a Shavua. It's nothing to do with me. So my great-great-great-great-grandfathers, grandmothers, whatever it may be, took a Shavua to HaKadosh Baruch Hu that this is what they're going to do, this is what they're not going to do. What does that do with me? What does that do with me? Here I am so many generations later, so many millennia later. How is that Shavua even relevant to my life at all? It's a good question. So what would you answer? Think about the first Shavua that we spoke about. What was the first Shavua? In Chumash it says, Yosef makes his brothers take a Shavua that they're going to bury him in Eretz Yisrael. His brothers aren't going to be alive. They're all going to die out. They're not going to live forever. It was a couple of hundred years till they came out of Mitzrayim. So what was his plan? What did he say? Hashbeya hishbiya. Yosef said, no, the Shavua is not only on you. I want you to take a Shavua to make sure that you're going to make your children take a Shavua as well. That's the way to get around the problem. How come over here, he asked, all of a sudden you come to this story of Hishbati Eschem Benos Yerushalayim, suddenly one generation took a Shavua to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, this is how they were going to behave, this is what they would do. How is that binding on me? How does that have any relevance to me? That was the question that was asked to the rugged shepherd. Take, for example, when I take a shua, let's say, or another, let's say I want to lose weight, right? So that's, we've all been there at some point in our lives, want to lose weight, I want to be careful. Not I want to lose weight, I don't care. I want to be careful with what I eat. So I want to be careful with what I eat, so what am I going to do? I'm going to take a nether upon myself. You know what? For the next 30 days, I'm not eating potato chips anymore. Right, that's going to help, not having the grease, not having the oil. I'm going to try to be a little bit more healthy. Fine, so I take a nether upon myself, no more potato chips for the next 30 days. Does that have any relevance to you? No, why not? Because a nether or a shvuah is something that's very personal. If I take a nether upon myself, it's binding on me. It's not binding on anyone else. I can't take a nether on your behalf. You can't take a nether on my behalf. What you can do is, if something belongs to you, let's say you have your laptop here, so you say, I hate Schefter so much, he's never allowed to use my computer. He's never allowed to use anything that belongs to me. So you're taking your property and you're saying that now that is off limits for me, but that's yours. So it has an implication for me, but you can't say that I am not allowed to do that. You're restricting me from doing something that I want to do. You can restrict me from your property, but you can't restrict me from doing my own thing. So what does it mean? That's the question that he asked the Rugged Shepherd. So he suggested as follows. What is the difference between the story by Yosef HaTzadik and the Shvua, Hishbati Eschem Menos Yerushalayim? You know what the difference is? What happened in between? Kabbalah Sator. What does Kabbalah Sator matter? The difference that Kabbalah Sator makes is we became a nation by Kabbalah Sator. There's a difference between the Jewish people at the time of Yetzias Mitzrayim and the Jewish people post-Kabbalah Sator. At the time of Yetzias Mitzrayim, the Jewish people were not Klal Yisrael yet. They were a bunch of Yechidim. They were single individual people. Yosef HaTzadik had to go to each of his brothers and say, Hashveya Hishviya, you take a Shvua, and you take a Shvua, and you take one for your children. And if he didn't explicitly include all future generations to be mushba, that their parents were going to actually make them take the shvuah, it would not have worked. Because how can I take a shvuah that has implications on you? How can I make a nether that has any relevance to your life? It doesn't work. Post Matan Torah, says the Rugged Shavar in the Tzafnas Paneach, when it says, Vayicham Sham Yisrael Neged Ahar, Ki Ish Echad B'Lev Echad, when we molded together to become one nation, then we all now are part of this much larger entity. We're no longer individuals. When the nation as a whole takes a shvuah upon itself, that's binding on all members of the nation. And even if you're going to be born way later on in history, you are still part of that nation. This is why Rav Soloveitchik said, from Rav Sadia Gaon, he writes a very famous line, Ein umosenu uma ela bitaraseha. You've heard that line before? We're the people of the book. Anyone ever heard that? The Jews are the people of the book. So some people think it means we read books. It's not what it means. Rav Sadia Gaon is the one who wrote that line. Einu Mosenu Uma Ela B'Torah Seha. What is our nation all about? We are a nation of Torah. That's what we stand for. That's what we represent. And that's where Soloveitchik said that this is the reason why when we bench Rosh Chodesh once a month, we say Mishal Sanisim Avosenu, and then we end up by saying Chai Veirim Kol Yisrael V'Nomar Amen. Right? Why are we talking about, oh, we're all friends, we're all happy? Why don't we throw that into any part of the davening? What's the relevance here? The relevance is, he said as follows, in the days of a Beis HaMikdash, how were they Kaveh the Chodesh? How did they declare was Rosh Chodesh? You had the Bezin in Yerushalayim, which was representative of the entire Jewish people, would accept witnesses, would accept Edim, and they would declare Rosh Chodesh. Now we don't have that today. So what do? We come together, Chaveirim Kol Yisrael, the Jewish community comes together on Shabbos Mevarchim. We declare Rosh Chodesh. What makes us bound to each other? What makes us Chaveirim? Just because we're friends? We have lots of friends, lots of acquaintances. What makes us bound together and the Jewish people that have the authority to now, as a nation, determine when Rosh Chodesh is going to be in the place of the Bez and Agadol in Yerushalayim? What allows us to do that is the Torah. Einu Mosenu Uma Ela B'Torah Seha. What makes us a nation is the Torah that bound us together, Ki Isha Chabalevacha. That's what made us Klal Yisrael. As a result of that, this is why the Minhag developed, that when we say this whole Birchas HaChodesh, we hold the Sefer Torah. Why do we hold the Sefer Torah? Because that's what gives us the license. That's what makes us feel that we are part of something much larger. And therefore, said the Rugged Shavar and the Tzafnas Paneach, this is why we find this major discrepancy between the story of Yosef HaTzadik, which was pre-Matan Torah, when every Jew was just considered to be a Yachid, living with his own family, doing their own thing, to later on when you come to a situation where you have the entity called Klal Yisrael. Once you have that, then it's a whole different story. Then it's a whole different discussion. And once you make a Shua with Klal Yisrael, that Shua is binding for all eternity, even for people that were not around at the time that the Shua was taken. Why is this relevant to our discussion about Minhagim? Many people have asked, why am I buying my family Minhag? What does my family Minhag have to do with me? What if I don't want that Minhag? So what is the Minhag all about? The Gemara says in Maseches Nedarim Daf Tezvav that the assumption is when a person takes upon themselves a neder, how does a neder work? I have to articulate with my words, I am trying to eat more healthy, and therefore I'm going to make sure not to eat potato chips for the next 30 days. If I don't articulate, it doesn't work. This is why there's so many details. The Gemara gets into all the minutiae. What if I take a neder and I say this? I left out this word. I left out that word. What exactly did I mean when I said potato chips? Doesn't mean Harris potato chips, Lay's potato chips, this, that. All the different permutations of what a neder could be or not be. That's the way a neder needs to be taken. Says the Gemara, if someone observes a minhag tov three times, if I do something good three times in a row, that's binding on me like a neder. What do you mean? But I didn't say anything. I didn't explicitly state, I want to do this three times in order that I should take it upon myself as a promise that I'm going to do it forever. That's never something that I stated explicitly. So why is it binding on me? So the Gemara says that midrabanan, even though it doesn't follow the general rules and all the permutations of how a nether has to be formulated, we say that midrabanan, somebody who does a minhag tov three times, it is binding on them like a nether midrabanan. That's the way it works. When you have a community that does something together, when you have a community that decides they're not going to eat kibbutz, right? You have a community that decides they're not going to eat kidneys, so the Sfardim never accepted it. The Ashkenazim did. So they don't eat kidneys on Pesach. The Sfardim have no problem eating kidneys on Pesach because they never accepted that. So when our community takes that upon themselves, or if you have a community where they wait 6 hours between eating meat and milk, or your community waits whatever it may be, anything like that, so why is that binding on me? It's a minhag tov, right? That's the minhag that we accepted upon ourselves, but I don't want it. If it was up to me, I would say, you know, let's do this over. I like the minhag of the German dissenting Jews that only keep 3 hours between meat and milk. So why is it binding on me? So the answer is, this is where it comes from. Hishbati esfen. It's that same idea. When you have a tzibur that takes something upon themselves, if you're a part of that tzibur, if you're a part of that entity, it's binding on you even though you never explicitly stated it. That's part of being a part of a community. It means you take upon yourself everything that the community stands for. And this is why we generally say that there's something as a minhag hayachid. I can take something upon myself, which is, I'm not going to eat potato chips because I want to be more healthy, I want to be more mindful. And then there's something called minhagei hatzibur. There's something that the kehila takes upon itself. And if I'm shayach to that kehila, it then becomes a problem for me to get rid of that. That's where minhagim really have their binding status. That's where it comes from. It's because we assume that once I'm shayach to a kehila, I take upon myself all of the different components that are part of that essence of that kehila. And therefore it is relevant to me as well. How does one get rid of that? How does one get rid of that? So my father writes in one of his svarim, if you choose to change kehilas, let's say I get married, and now I married a Sephardi. So do you say that now I'm not allowed to eat kidneys because I grew up in an Ashkenazi house? The answer is no. I'm no longer shayach to the Ashkenazi community. I'm now shayach to the Sephardi community. If I move, my family used to live in Lakewood where they had these minhagim, and now I live in, you know, in Queens where they do something else. And the minhagim are totally different. So now, as time evolves, I now become a part of a different kehila. Now, how exactly that works, how much time has to pass, how long do I need to be there? And we're not going to say every time a person moves, all of a sudden they should just change everything. It has to be within reason. It has to be something that is really a permanent move. It's that I'm really planting myself in this kehila, and I say, this is really where I want to be. And I'm uprooting where I come from because I'm saying that that's no longer a part of what my kehila really stands for. But that's really the underpinning of why it is that I'm bound by minhagim. When we have a minhag, it's something that we need to keep very, very seriously. So let's look a little bit into this. And really, that's what Rashi writes in this week's parsha. Al yishana adam min ha-minhag ha-makam. That a person should keep the minhag ha-makam, even though it may not make sense to you. To the malachim, this made no sense at all. Why would they follow this minhag? What do the malachim have that they need to eat? They're not interested in following this, but they did it anyway because that was the minhag ha-makom, and they did not want to go astray from that. And from there we learn, Rashi says, that we should do the very same. I find a very fascinating Gemara. The Gemara, I think it's in Masechet Sanhedrin, I forgot where, but the Gemara talks about, how do we know that there is an obligation of kura? How do we know there's a mitzvah to bury the dead? So the Gemara says, what do you mean? What's the question? It says, cover tikburena bayamahu. It says that you have to bury somebody after they pass away. Oh, says the Gemara, not so fast. Where is that pasuk stated? So we all know it's in Sefer Tvarim. We didn't get there yet, so that's why we're not up there. So we all know it's in Sefer Tvarim, but what's the context? The Torah there is talking about capital punishment. When every once in a while you have to administer capital punishment and the Beis Din has to give someone the death penalty. So the Torah says, Lo sala nivlaso ala eitz, cover tikurena bayamahu. You have to make sure to bury the person after you administer capital punishment. You have to go ahead and bury them. Treat them with dignity and respect. Okay. Says the Gemara, how do you know if someone's not Haruge Beis Din? Maybe it's only limited to that person. Nebuch, he feels so bad, we have to kill you. It's such a terrible thing that we have to take your life because of capital punishment. Maybe we're going to be nice to you and bury you. How do you know that applies to everyone else? The Gemara says, come on, it doesn't make sense. Let's look back in Chumash. Avraham Avinu was buried. So the Gemara says, no, maybe that was just the conventional thing to do. What are you going to do? Just leave bodies all over the street? So Avraham Avinu wanted to bury his wife Sarah, so that's why he decided to do it, because it was the nice, respectful thing to do. But how do you know it's a mitzvah? So Gemara says, Yitzchak, Yaakov, whatever, all these different things. Says the Gemara, I'll bring you a proof that's irrefutable. What's the proof? What's the proof? Who's the greatest proof in Chumash that there must be a mitzvah of Kfura? Yeah? That's here, yeah?
Yosef,
why?
Because he made a swear to brothers that they would eventually come out very.
So maybe you'll say Yosef because he made the brother swear, but maybe you'll say that's just because Yosef wanted to be buried like everybody else. That's Moshe, knew. That's the proof, says the Gemara. Moshe Rabbeinu was buried by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The Ribbono Shel Olam doesn't just do things, just stop. So the Gemara says, if HaKadosh Baruch Hu felt it was important enough for him to take out of his busy schedule and bury Moshe Rabbeinu, it means that burial is obviously an important thing to do. It means it's a mitzvah. So isn't that a raya? Isn't that a proof that there's a mitzvah of kvura? Says the Gemara, no. Why? Dilma delo lishani miminhaga. Maybe HaKadosh Baruch Hu just wanted to follow the minhag. And because it's conventional in the world that after somebody passes away, we bury them, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu did the same thing. What else is he going to do? And what I take out of that Gemara is, again, it's a line that is usually glossed over because it's not so profound. It's just the Gemara is pushing aside the proof from HaKadosh Baruch Hu burying Moshe Rabbeinu. But listen to the profundity of the line. What we're saying is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu did something to follow the minhag. What do you mean? You created the world. You can do what you want. The answer is no. If this is the convention, if this is what people do, then I should go along with it. Even if my name is the Melech Malchei HaMelechim HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I still go along with it. And I think that's a very powerful message in general about the importance of minhagim and about the understanding that we need to have of how critical it is that we adhere and we respect and follow the minhagim of our families, the minhagim of our communities. So let's look at the Sefer Chut HaMashulash. Sefer Chut HaMashulash is a biography of Rabbi Kiva Eger, the Chasam Sofer, and the son of the Chasam Sofer, who was the Ksav Sofer. So it's interesting. Rabbi Kiva Eger and the Chasam Sofer were, I think, 1 year apart from each other. But the Chasam Sofer ended up becoming the son-in-law of Rabbi Kiva Eger. So that's very unusual, right? That's not the norm. How can that be that he was 1 year younger than his father-in-law? It was a second marriage. The Rabbi Kiva Eger's daughter lost her first husband. And Rabbi Kiva Eger said, hey, there's nobody in the world that would love to marry my daughter more than the Chasam Sofer. He loved him so much. They were so close. So he ended up becoming his son-in-law. But they were very close in age and very close correspondence with each other. So Rabbi Kiva Eger and the Chasam Sofer, and the Ksav Sofer is the son of the Chasam Sofer. So the biography is called the Chut HaMashulash, which means the three together made this dynasty, and they were all written about in great detail. So if you look here, they write, why is it that it's so important that we follow them and hug it? So they write as follows, V'taymo u'mamasho, shehikbid kol kach al menhagi Yisrael. They write, Why was it that the Chasam Sofer was such a stickler for Minhagi Yisrael? Why was he so insistent that there could be no room at all for any kind of compromise when it comes to Minhagi Yisrael? It's just a Minhag! It's just a Minhag! What are you going so to the extreme for? He explains as follows. Yan, kihema gedarim usyagim legufei haTorah. Explain the Chasam Sofer. Because Minhagim are what safeguard the Torah. Kimosha Godrim kol bayis leman lo yavo haparzim miyad el habayis penima. The same way we lock the door and we put cameras around the house and we put a fence around the backyard to make sure that nobody breaks in. Kein hadavar azeh. That's the way this works as well. Umisha rotza lahavir eza minhag tum asa b'shulav umei ra el ra yetze. If you begin to knock off the Minhagim and you don't respect them and you don't follow them, one thing will lead to the next. Gam el mitzvahs haTorah atzman. It will lead to a person neglecting the mitzvahs haTorah themselves. So this is like the safeguard. If you keep to the Minhagim, you'll ultimately be able to keep to the difficult mitzvahs haTorah as well. Once you start to break down, once you start getting rid of this, you're going to get rid of everything, says the Chasam Sofer. And then he writes further. Be'emes, the truth is, Minhagi Yisrael Torah Hema. He says, Minhagi Yisrael are actual Torah. Umaragle bepume shalach samsofer. The samsofer said, "Kimi she'eno ela Torah, someone who only has Torah and is not careful and scrupulous about minhagim, afilu Torah eino. Without the mesorah, without the minhagim, what do you have? How do you know how to do anything? Without the tradition, which tells us how to do everything, and therefore he said it's important that we keep clear to the Minhagim, that we understand what the Minhagim are all about. There is an absolutely incredible story about Rabbi Kiva Eger, in which he paskined a shayla lahalacha based off of a minhag Yisrael. Anyone knows the story I'm about to say? It's an amazing story. So, how many of you have been to a ksivas osius of a Sefer Torah? Right? So, what generally happens? Let's get a volunteer to tell us what, like, if you can describe to me, I'm a Baal Tshuva. I have no idea what this is like. I get an invitation in the mail. Like, we're finishing a Sefer Torah. Please come join us in the house. Four. And I'm like, I go over to someone in shul the next day. I'm like, what is this? Like, what are we doing? Just, like, walk me through the process. What happens? Yeah?
They finish writing the words.
Who's they?
So usually the Sofer takes it to, like, the family bar or the Romanian. And we finish filling the words. And then...
So I ask again, who's the they?
The family. The Sofer helps the family finish the words.
Okay, all right.
And then everybody collectively who's there dances with the Torah.
Great. Sounds wonderful. So I signed up. I want to come. It's amazing. So on one occasion, the story goes as follows. There was a Sefer Torah that was found on the side of the road somewhere. Nobody knew the whereabouts of the Sefer Torah. Nobody knew who it belonged to. Somebody found it. They walk into the local shul and they say, look, we found the Sefer Torah on the side of the road. We're traveling from city A to city B. We can't take this with us. But at least you should have it in the shul. You should make use of it. The shul is very excited. The problem is, we don't know if it's a kosher Sefer Torah. So what do you mean you don't know if it's a kosher Sefer Torah? Read it. Look if it has the words written properly or not. So they start reading through. The problem is, what's the problem? Not every Sefer Torah that's written, even if it has all the right words, not every Sefer Torah is kosher. What can be wrong? So the Shulchan Aruch says, if you have a Sefer Torah, shekasvo min. If you have a Sefer Torah which was written by a sofer, by a scribe, who is an apikores, who doesn't believe in God, that Sefer Torah is pasul. So even though everything looks perfect and everything's right, and all the words are exactly where they should be, and the columns are situated as they should be, if it was written by somebody who is a min, who is an apikores, who doesn't believe in HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that Sefer Torah cannot be used. Not only can it not be used, I think the Shulchan Aruch says, Yisarif. It says it has to be burnt. So how are they supposed to determine whether or not the Sefer Torah is able to be used? How should they know? They have no information on the case. They don't know whether or not this was written by a Jew in the first place. They don't know if it was written by an apikores. So what should they do? So they sent a shayla to Rabbi Kiva Eger. Some travelers were passing by the neighborhood. They told us about the Sefer Torah they found on the side of the road. We're just asking you, what should we do? What's the protocol? Rabbi Kiva Eger said, I want you to roll it to the back of the Torah, to the last column, and I'm going to decide. Okay? They rolled it to the end of the Sefer Torah. He looks at the last paragraph, and he says, the Sefer Torah is pasul. It has to be burnt. Everybody was wondering, what did he see in the last paragraph? What went wrong? He said, Minhag Yisrael is that we make Hachnasa Sefer Torah, and we leave over the last column, the last paragraph, for all the family members, the community members to come. Everybody writes a letter. Everyone gets involved. There's a lot of pushing around. So he said, there's no way when you have a sofer who's sitting for a full year in his own little study, by his own desk, writing a Sefer Torah, everything's going to be perfect, right? He's going to be careful. When he gets to the last paragraph and everybody's pushing around and you have family members saying, oh, I want a letter, this one wants a letter, that one, and everyone's all over the place, it's not going to be as symmetrical as everything else. It's not going to be as straight. This one is straight like everything else. It means they didn't follow Minhag Yisrael. It means they didn't have people come and fill in the last few osios of the Sefer Torah. Otherwise, it wouldn't be straight. If they didn't follow Minhag Yisrael, it means it was obviously written by an apikoros. You can burn it. That's an amazing psak. Yeah?
What if he wrote it, he donated it, and wrote it?
Who?
Whoever told that was.
So Rabbi Kivayeger was saying, the minhag is that whenever you donate a Sefer Torah, you invite the community together to come and write letters. That's the way it goes.
Even if they're not the one donating it, they can just write a letter in it?
Yeah, that's the way it works. Sure, yeah. So that's why I asked that you should define clearly who's the they when you have Hachnasa Sefer Torah. So generally you have all kinds of members of the community come and they all write a letter and they're all involved and everyone's pushing and everyone's screaming and yelling. So it doesn't come out as beautiful as the rest of the Sefer Torah, but Rabbi Kivayeger said that is the beauty of the Sefer Torah, that we're following Minhag Yisrael. That's not a pagam, that's not a blemish in the Sefer Torah, that's what makes the Sefer Torah kosher. So he said, just by looking at the last paragraph, and I find that to be a fascinating psak of Rabbi Kivayeger, to the point that he was willing to actually burn a Sefer Torah as a result of just a Minhag Yisrael. Look at their Amman Siman Taf Reish Yud Tes. Anybody know what Siman is Siman Taf Reish Yud Tes in Shulchan Aruch? Like, what area of halacha is that?
Shabbat.
Nope, Shabbos is in like Shin, you know. Taf Reish Yud Tes is the very end of Shulchan Aruch, of Shulchan Aruch Aruch Haim. It's in Hilchos Yom Noroim. And here, he quotes something from the Maharil. The Maharil lived in the 1300s, passed away in 1427. The Rama lives in the 1500s, passed away in 1572. So the Rama was very much, very heavily influenced by the Maharil, who was the father of Chachmei Ashkenaz. So he writes as follows, in the name of the Maharil. And this is when he's talking about the Chazin on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur and Shul has to make sure that he follows the minhagim of the Shul. So he writes as follows, Al Yishana Adam Yiminaka Yir, a person should not veer away from the minhag of the town when it comes to the davening Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Afilu b'nigunim o piyutim sha'omim sham. Nobody has to tell me where they live. It bothers me when I come to shul on Yom Naram or any Shabbos. Somebody decides you're going to be the wonderful chazan who's going to use a tune that nobody knows. I find it very annoying. I didn't come to shul to hear you sing. I came to shul to daven. I didn't come to hear your concert. First of all, you don't have a good voice. And aside from that, I didn't come to shul to hear a concert. I came to shul because I want to be involved. I want to participate. So you decided to come up with some new tune that nobody in the shul knows? Says the Rama, you got to be very careful. Al Yishana Adam Yimino Ge'ir Afilu B'nigunim O B'piyutim Sha'omrim Sha'am. So the Rama in general is very trite. He's very like short on his words. Usually he just puts a little comment here, a little comment there, one line, two words, something like that. Here, he quotes in the Maharil, one line. But if you look in the original Maharil, you'll see the whole story. What's the story? A frightening story. Let's read the story together. Amar Mahari Sega, number Dalek. The Maharil said, "Ein l'shanos minhag hamakom b'shum inyan." The Maharil in the original. Now again, the Rama just took the bottom line. What's the bottom line? When the Chazan davens for the Yomer, you should make sure to follow the minhag, sing the same songs, say the right piyutim, don't change it. The original story in the Maharil is as follows: Amar Maharil Segel, that is the Maharil. He said, "Ein l'shanos minhag hamakom b'shum inyan." Do not change the minhag. Afilu b'nigunim sheim urgalim sham. Don't sing a niggin that they're not used to there. Why? Because no one's going to be able to participate. V'siper lanu ma'isa ba'atzmo. The Maharil told us a story about himself. Shahaya shliach tzibur pamachas b'kehilas Regensburg b'yam Naraim. He was the chazan in a certain town on Yam Naraim. V'ahim enagin kol ha'tfila keminig medinas Ostrai. He came from a certain community that was called Ostrai. He found himself one year Yam Naraim in another community. They asked him to down for the Yamud. And instead of following the rule book of this community, he decided, I'm the Maharil, I'm going to sing the songs from my community, from Mastreich, I'm going to say the piyutim the way we say it, I'm not going to follow the minhag here. Ki kein haminhag sham. V'huksha be'einav shayomim haftorah b'nigin b'nei rinus. And then they came up to the haftorah, he wasn't happy with how they were laying it, but that was the minhag, but he wasn't happy. V'amar, and he said, Shavuoso pam, hu amar slicha, ani hamedaber. I don't know exactly what this means, but he said, we're going to say these slichos, those piyutim. He started changing it around. Asher yasad Rabbeinu Ephraim, lomar l'tfilas musaf v'sabar, and he thought, Shemitzvah lomar sham l'chvod Rabbeinu Ephraim ha-mechaber, asher menu chaso kavod sham. He came there, he started changing around everything. And he said, what do you mean? Rabbeinu Ephraim lived in your town. He was one of the Rishonim. You're not going to follow Rabbeinu Ephraim's piyutim that he wrote? And they turned to him and they said, we don't say it. What do you mean? He said, no, but you have to say it. Back and forth, the whole argument. Sounds like a very Lady Dick Rosh Hashanah there. V'yamram anhigim elav. And the Gabbai came over to him. He says, Maharil, I love you, but ein min hagam lomar osa haslicha. V'lo shama aleim misvarasa delal. The Maharil said, look, you're saying you don't have the minhag, but I don't understand why. This doesn't make sense. So he ignored the Gabbai. Liyamim, the Maharil said about himself, Mesa bas hara b'yom ha-kippur. The Maharil's daughter passed away on Yom Kippur. V'hitzte karav amnizkar alav hadin shelaksa bito almasha shina miminak amak. This story is terrifying. But this is in the Maharil. Now I understand why the Ramah left out the rest of the gory details of the story, because it's terrifying. But if you look in the original, this is what the Maharil says. You have to stick to the minhag. And he says, bididi halayuvda. I had a story where I served as the chazan of Rosh Hashanah. I tried to change up all the different things that the shul was doing. And for good reason. It's not because he had his own particular interest in mind. He thought this was more correct. That's more correct. We should do things this way instead of that way. And he paid a tremendous price. Now, how do you understand the story? Why should his daughter suffer because of something that he did? And is that really something that makes sense? HaKadosh Baruch Hu would go to such an extreme? I don't know. I don't know how to explain it. But this is what the Maharil says. I'll give you another very interesting example. Another very interesting test case. So we know the Torah says we have a mitzvah of Nesias Kapayim. When do we have a chiyuv Nesias Kapayim? When do we have a chiyuv for a Kohen to give the Birchas Kohanim? What? In Eretz Yisrael, it's every day. And here? On Yom Tovim. Why should there be a difference? So let's look back in the pasuk in Chumash. What does it say? V'samu eshmi al b'nei Yisrael v'ani avarchem. You should bless the Jewish people. If you bless them, I'll bless them, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says. Nowhere does it say, if you're in Eretz Yisrael, you should give a bracha every day. If you're in Chutz La'aretz, you only give a bracha a couple of times a year. So what's this all about? So the Ramah says, in order for a Kohen to effectively give a bracha, he has to be in a state of simcha. He has to be in a happy mood. And the Ramah says, when are we in a state of simcha? We're in a state of simcha on Yom Tov. So therefore we do it. Aye, what about Eretz Yisrael? So the assumption is in Eretz Yisrael they're happy. The Ramah says, the Ramah lived in Krakow in Poland, so the Ramah says, we have daigas ha-parnasa. You know, we always have worries on our head, so the Kohen is not going to have a clear mind in the morning when he gets up to do the Nesias Kapayim. So that's why we don't do it. So Rabbi Avram Shapiro, the Rosh Hashiva of Merkaz Harav, once asked my father, so what about in Eretz Yisrael? He said, nobody works here. No daigas ha-parnasa. So we have to explain. So that sounds like a very nice interpretation, but the bottom line is, the Torah says, the Kohen should be duchening every single day. You can't find the Kohen who's in a good mood. You don't have one Kohen in the neighborhood who's retired, whose stocks are doing just fine, who's not worried about it. Really? There's no Kohen who's not going to work today? Doesn't make sense. So why do we not duchen in Chutz La'aretz? It sounds like a very far-fetched reasoning and a very strange way to get rid of an actual mitzvah haseh m'deoraisa every single day. So this is something that bothered many of the Gedolei Achronim, trying to figure out what's the justification why in Chutz La'aretz we don't do Nesias Kapayim. Writes the Aruch HaShulchan, V'hinei, Aruch HaShulchan passed away in 1908, so he's pretty recent. V'hinei, and he says, V'adai ein shum tam nachon lemin hagenu, Levatal mitzvah saseh deberchas kohanim kala shana kula. There is absolutely no justification. There is no defense for this practice. Why do we not duchen every day? So the Ramah says, because we're not happy. Dagis ha-pranasa. Come on. What do you mean? How could that be? Says the Aruch HaShulchan, He sees no justification for this, no rationale. Uminhag garuahu, says the Aruch HaShulchan, this is a terrible minhag. Where did this come from? I don't understand. Avaman aser, what should I do? Kilu basko yatsa, it's as if a heavenly voice came out. Shalola aniach lanu lisa kapayim mechala shana kula. It's as if there was a basko that came out and told us, don't do nesias kapayim during the year, it's reserved for yamtiv. What's he talking about? What's this basko? What's that a reference to? Basko came out min hashamayim and told us not to duchen? Who ever heard of this basko? Anyone knows what he's referencing? What? Lo b'shamayim is a good question. But what's he meaning? He's using it as like a like there's some reason why we don't do this. I don't exactly understand why, but like I don't have a choice. Like my hands are tied. Why are your hands tied? What's the issue?
I think that happens a lot though.
You think what happens
a lot? Like a lot of the times in Tanakh, like a lot of the parsha like use the gospel to explain a lot of unknown things.
Depends what? Depends what. The Gemara says, Lo b'shamayim means if a basko comes out and says we should paskin like A or B, we should paskin like B'shamay or B'silo or Ramey or Rabbi Yehuda, we wouldn't listen to the basko because the Torah is for us to figure out. If you want to understand, let's say HaKadosh Baruch Hu is bringing some tzara to a person's life and all of a sudden you have a basko comes out and says you should be doing tshuva for this or you should be working on that, that's a basko that's giving you a message. That's what we wish we had, right? There's nevuah. So what exactly does he mean here? What is he talking about? So you look in the Netziv. The Netziv passed away about 10 or 15 years before the Aruch HaShulchan. They were actually related. So the Netziv tells us the story. What is the Aruch HaShulchan referencing here? He's referencing the following two stories. Let's read it. Vizachrini, and I remember, Sheshamati, that I heard, Kemeduma Mechosni Rab Itzel HaBalazhan. Says, I think I heard from my family member, Rab Itzel HaBalazhan, or the following. Shepamachas, the Vilna Gaon had a very hard time understanding why it is that we don't do Nesias Kapayim every day in Chutz La'aretz. Pamachas Hiskim Rabbeinu Hagra, on one occasion the Vilna Gaon decided, you know what, enough is enough. We're living in Chutz La'aretz, we're Mevatel Mitzvah Saseh every single day. Why do we not do Nesias Kapayim? Vilna Gaon hung up signs and he said, tomorrow all the Kohanim have to come to Shul on time. We're going to do Nesias Kapayim, we're changing the Minhag. Okay, what happened? Bechol Yom Beis Midrasho. He said, from here on in, we're going to do Nesias Kapayim. V'ikvu min hashamayim. Min hashamayim, they didn't let him. That night, Milkach lebeisa asurim be'esa machlokes hanarab b'vilna lo aleinu. There was some politics going on, and they arrested the Vilna Gaon that night. And he took it as a simon min hashamayim. This was a bad idea. I shouldn't have hung up these signs that we're going to do Nesias Kapayim. If that wasn't enough, the Vilna Gaon then had a Talmud. Who was his Talmud? Who was the greatest Talmud of the Vilna Gaon? Reb Chaim Velazhner, Nefesh HaChaim. So Reb Chaim Velazhner said, listen, the Rebbe, the Vilna Gaon, said that really we should do Nesias Kapayim every day. Something happened min HaShamayim. They didn't let him do it. They arrested the Vilna Gaon. You know what? I'm going to try it. So then when the Reb Chaim Velazhner became the leader of his community, he decided he was going to try. What happens? Achar kach, the Avir HaRoim, Arenu Reb Chaim, Hiskim Yom Echad, he decided, Shaviyom HaMachros, Yitzav Elisa Kapayim. He goes through the whole thing again. He says, we're following the Vilna Gaon Shita. We're hanging up signs all over town in Valazhin. Tomorrow the Kohanim have to come on time. We're going to start doing the Nesias Kapayim and Shul. Ba'osa Laila that night, Nisraf Chatzi Ha'ir U'Beis HaKnesset Shava'ir. That night, half the city of Valazhin burned down, including the Shul. V'rov is Bonanu, and everybody realized, She'yesh bozeh ezer davar so b'sisri hashbaz habracha hayorid al-yidei berchas Kohanim b'chutz la'aretz. So we don't know why. We don't exactly understand why. Based on the cut and dry halacha, does it make sense? Not really. We don't really understand the justification as to why it is that we don't do Nesias Kapayim every day. It's a bitul mitzvah saseh, which is a very unusual thing for us to do, and yet, that is the minhag. And the Vilna Gaon tried to change the minhag, and Reb Chaim Velazhner tried to change it, and they were shown min hashamayim, don't play with the minhag. You don't understand it? Let it be. Powerful story. But again, it shows us a very interesting perspective about Minhagim in general and how binding they are, even sometimes when we may feel that we don't fully understand it. There's an unbelievable story told about the Ramah. I don't know how familiar you are with the Psakim of the Ramah, but often the Ramah and Shulchan Aruch The Mechaber and the Rama actually lived at the same time. Shulchan Aruch and the Rama lived at the same time. One lived in, where did the Shulchan Aruch live?
Svat.
And where did the Rama live? In Poland, in Krakow. They were both trying to do the same thing at the same time. They were both trying to write a Shulchan Aruch. They both lived in the 1500s. They both tried to write the same thing. The problem was, Rabbi Yosef Karo got it out first. So he put out the Shulchan Aruch. Now, the Rama looks at it and he says, what am I going to do? Write the same thing? So he's working on this thing for years. And then he realizes somebody did it first. Well, I'm not going to become his competition. I may as well just take the Shulchan Aruch and write my comments on the Shulchan Aruch, and then we'll both be good. So what he did was, he basically wrote a elucidation of the Shulchan Aruch to say, I agree with everything the Shulchan Aruch says, except for these little things here and there where he changes the psak of the Shulchan Aruch and he writes what the Ashkenazim do, what the minig is, all things like that. That's what the Rama is. Okay. Now, very often in the Rama you will find, he writes, V'chei no'agim, V'hachi na'aginan, this is what we do, this is the minig. He's like very stuck on the minhagim. He always says, this is the minig, that's the minig, this is how we do it, which my father always pointed out. You know, B'medinos elu, this is what we do. This is the minhag. That's what the Rama writes. Anyone ever been to the Rama Shul in Krakow? How big is it? The size of this room. So it's like interesting. The Rama says, in our shul, this is what we do. In your shul is smaller than the shtiebel, you know, down the block from me. But the Rama is saying, not in my shtiebel, he's saying in Ashkenaz, in Kehilas Ashkenaz, this is what we do. And that's what he feels the minhag is. So it's been asked, why is it that the Rama is such a stickler for the minhagim? Again, minhagim are important, but you find so often that he throws in v'hachi nahaginan v'chein minhagim, so much focus on the minhagim. So the story is documented as follows. They tell the story that when the Rama was the Rav in Krakow, there was a minhag in the community that he found to be very strange. What was the minhag? The minhag was that when a woman went to the mikveh at the end of her cycle of nidus, so we know that a mikveh has to be run by a mikveh lady. Somebody has to administer the mikveh. Somebody has to be there to make sure that the tefillah goes properly. But in general, the Shulchan Aruch says that when a woman goes to the mikveh, it should not be public information. It should be something private between the couple themselves. So that's what we try to do. And I always tell Chasan and Kala, when they come to talk to me before a wedding, I always say, you'll see, there's an entire underworld of Taharas HaMishpacha that like nobody else knows about. And it's beautiful, it's so private, and it's so fascinating how you can live in a community and your children live in your house. I don't want to ask, how many of you know when your mothers are going to the mikveh? I assume many of you, maybe at this age you've already figured it out. When your mother says, I'm going to so many shidduch meetings, and they always happen to be at the same time of the month, maybe you figured it out. But for the most part, it's really, really fascinating how there's this beautiful world of Taharas HaMishpacha that's supposed to remain a very private enterprise between a husband and wife. And the Shulchan Aruch says we should be makbid, we should try that the woman should not publicize when she's going to the mikveh. Now in this community, the Rama comes to Krakow, and they had a very strange minhag. The minhag was that in the morning, in shul, after shacharis, after the woman went to the mikveh the night before, the husband of the mikveh lady, right, who obviously wasn't involved in the mikveh, but his wife was, the husband of the mikveh lady came to shul with a list of who was there last night, and he would go over to the husband whose wife had just gone to the mikveh, he would wish him a mazel tov. That was the minhag. Now, you're rolling your eyes, it's very strange. The Rama also rolled his eyes, and he says, this makes no sense! Going over to him and publicizing that his wife went to the mikveh last night? This sounds insane. Why would you do such a thing? The Rama says, we're stopping this. This doesn't make sense. No more coming to shul with the list. I mean, this is crazy. So the Rama stopped it. Okay. Happens to be, the Rama stopped it, everyone accepted it. There was one individual who was on a business trip when the Rama stopped it. So he was away for 2 months. And over the last 2 months, everyone's getting used to the new minhag, and they're no longer wishing mazel tov, and they're no longer talking about it in the morning. Fine. He comes back from his business trip, and he shows up to shul one day, and he's waiting after davening for the mikveh attendant's husband to come over to him and wish him a mazel tov. And he didn't. Now, why didn't he? He didn't because the Rama said, we're stopping the minhag. So 2 months before, he had already stopped this, but he was out of town, so he didn't know. So he's waiting and waiting, looking around, trying to catch his attention, wants to see what's going on. He realizes, he obviously hates me. And he starts getting into a whole argument with him. He starts yelling at him, I always knew you hated me. You're the gabe of the shul. You never give me an aliyah. You never let me down for the yomid. You always make me sit in the back. And now, when my wife went to the mikvah last night, you didn't wish me a mazel tov. And I know now it's confirmed how much you hate me. The man turns back to his husband and says, I hate to break it to you. The mikvah was actually closed last night. So, your wife wasn't there, and nobody's wife was there. And aside from that, the Rama actually stopped this minhag 2 months ago. So, we're not wishing mazel tov to anybody anymore. Husband says, what do you mean the mikvah was closed? My wife said she went to the mikvah. He says, well, she didn't show up. And they went back, and it was clarified that this woman was always concerned that if she's not going to go to the mikvah, her husband will find out. So all those years, although she was reluctant to use the mikvah, she always did because she knew they're going to blow her cover the next morning. But now that the Rama stopped the minhag, she had nothing to deter her. So she lied to her husband and said she used the mikvah the night before. And the Rama said from here he learned, we don't play with the minhagim. We don't play with the minhagim. It didn't make sense to him. He didn't like it. We don't play with the minhagim. That's what the Rama said. And that's why some say that that's why the Rama gives such a strong infusion into the Shulchan Aruch, where he writes, V'cheinoagim, V'hachinoaginan, almost to make up for his meddling with the minhagim, the Rama felt he had to go to the opposite extreme and throw in the minhagim everywhere and reinforce the fact that we need to follow minhagim as much as we possibly can. Now it's important, the Chazon Ish points out to us, that it's important that a person understand, when we talk about a minhag, it has to be something that was established al taharas hakodesh. There are many minhagim that our community has that were not established based on any of the great leaders of any community. It's just something that came to be. Actually, we had a whole day of amazing shiurim yesterday with Rabbi Aaron Lapiansky. Yes, a shout out to Silver Spring. So I brought him in. I had a rabbinical conference for around 50 rabbanim yesterday. So Rabbi Lapiansky spoke, and he told us a great story in the middle. And it's so sad how pathetic it is, but it's like all of us can imagine that this is true. So he said there was a boy who came to the yeshiva, and he was from a very, very wealthy family. And Rabbi Lapiansky said he was not from Silver Spring. He was from another community. He was from New York, he said. And he said he was from a very wealthy family, and his family was very interested in showing the fact that they had this kind of lifestyle. So they sent their son to the yeshiva with a Lexus, which was, at that time, an outrageous car to drive, especially for a young boy. Anyway, he shows up at the yeshiva, and then over the course of time, something went wrong in the family, and someone got very sick. And the boy came to Rabbi Lapiansky, and he said, it came to my attention that maybe there's a little bit of an ayin hara. So, how would you end up that sentence? There's an ayin hara, and my question is, if... should I get rid of the car, right? That's the way I would have presented the question. He says, and my question is, should I wear a red string? Should I wear a red string? This is insane. Nobody's laughing because it's so pathetic. Should I wear a red string? You should get rid of the stupid car. Get rid of the ayin hara. That's the way to get rid of an ayin hara. So we have certain things that the community does. That's not minhag. That's something that's been started by who knows what. Actually, when it comes to a red string, the Gemara actually writes that a red string is very questionable. That may actually be nichush. When the Gemara says that there are certain things you're not allowed to do, the Gemara actually gives that example about putting a red string on your arm. Is that considered to be nichush or perhaps something that is just meaningless, something that's nothing at all? But the Chazon Ish encourages us to think, when you have a minhag, you need to look into the origins of the minhag and ask yourself, what is this all about? Where did this minhag come from? Where did it start? Who told you to do this? So not every minhag is sacred. Not everything that we're told to do is something that actually stems from a kosher and holy place. And it's something for us to keep in mind, which is why Rabbeinu Tam writes in one of his svarim, in the Sefer HaYashar of Rabbeinu Tam, the Mordechai brings it also, one of the Rishonim brings it from Rabbeinu Tam, that Minag, if you'll notice, is the same letters as Gehenna. So he says sometimes following a minag is very important, but sometimes you can be following a minag that actually makes no sense at all and has no very holy roots. And that's why he says we have to be very, very aware of the fact that whenever we observe a minag, while minhagim are extremely important, only minhagim that have very sacred and holy roots are ones that we should all be following. So, yes, question.
Why do